And we're joined by David Jacobs, who's not that far away. Are you there, David?
I'm here, yes.
Now, David, thanks very much for joining us. We were just speaking to David Heap, who is has written a letter to the leaders of the NDP. Of course, his father was a distinguished member of Parliament from Trinity, and he is asking that they speak up on this issue, and he takes up the matter of international law, and which he says, incidentally, he cites, I guess it's Judge, we used to call her Judge Prelay, I don't forget her title now, but she says that all nations have to be equal before the law, and any accusations of violations, particularly serious ones, egregious ones, need to be investigated. He's asking the NDP if they would agree with that. I suspect so far there's no response. But now, I want people to know you, of course, have practiced international law. You've been part of many forums. You've written on the matter. And you are, of course, a close colleague of a distinguished professor, recently deceased, Michael Mandel, who wrote the wonderful book, How America Gets Away with Murder. Which, looking at a situation now, apropos of Gaza, and Michael Mandel spoke out on this, and I wonder if you could just sort of channel his thoughts a little bit. How do you think he would react to this current situation?
Well, it's a pretty tall order. You know, Michael was a very distinguished scholar in this and wrote some terrific and very scholarly articles about international law and how it speaks to the situation in Gaza. But what I was struck with when I was looking at his articles, he's been writing about this for a long time, is how they could have been written today. Unfortunately, as we all know, that Michael died much before his time in October of last year. But maybe I could have your listeners just listen to this. He writes this, did self-defense justify Israel's war on Gaza? Objections have been raised to this claim on the grounds of both a lack of both proportionality and necessity. To kill over 1,000 Palestinians in 3 weeks, hundreds of them children, wound thousands more, in order to deter a threat from rockets that didn't kill or injure anybody in Israel. For the 6 months the truce was declared by both sides, or even before Israel launched its attack on December 27, is so disproportionate as to be intolerable in any ethical system that holds Palestinian lives equal in value to Israeli lives. It's also so disproportionate as to defy belief that defense against these rockets was the real motive of the war. To ignore the many diplomatic avenues available to avoid this threat, such as lifting the suffocating 18-month siege, suggests the same thing. A more fundamental objection, however, is the legal and moral principle that an aggressor cannot rely upon self-defense to justify violence against resistance to its own aggression. I'm going to stop reading now, but that article is written by Michael. It's published in Counterpunch. The title of the article is Self-Defense Against Peace, Israel's Unjust War on Gaza, and it's dated February 5, 2009.
2009.
And if you troll the
he could have written that today.
Absolutely. And if you troll the internet, you'll find, for example, an interview with Michael on Al Jazeera. It's on YouTube. All you need to do is Google, frankly, all you need to do is Google Michael Mandel and Gaza, or Michael Mandel and international law and Israel. And you'll find many, many articles that he had written, which, again, could have been written today or yesterday. He has a very comprehensive article that was written and published in the spring of 2011 by the Dartmouth Law Journal, spring 2011, called Israel and Palestine, Three Questions for International Law. But what struck me when I was reading his writings is how little international law is actually discussed. I mean, people toss phrases around, like Israel's right to self-defense and indiscriminate bombing and so on. But Michael says, and again, if you don't mind me reading a little bit, he says, legality clearly resonates powerfully in the political arena. It's an important way of arguing about things, of justifying and criticizing them, distinct from other forms of moral and pragmatic argument. What is its appeal? It could have to do with its democratic credentials. And he points out, for example, the International Court of Justice, which has pronounced on the situation between Israel and the territories it occupies, is has pretty solid democratic and international credentials, composed of judges elected by mass majority vote of the General Assembly of the UN. So to unpack what I think I understand Michael to be saying is that if you look at Israel's claim, and it always has the same claim, 2009-2012, now in terms of its confrontation with Gaza, that it is acting in self-defense. So the first question, the question that almost nobody on television ever asks, is what is the status of Gaza and the West Bank? And the answer to that is really simple in international law. Israel is an occupying power. So how do we know that? You can analyze it and say, well, Israel militarily occupied Gaza and the West Bank after the 67 war, and it maintains effective control over the West Bank since it claimed to have withdrawn from the West Bank in 2005. So, frankly, everybody in the world, with the sole exception of Israel, there may be one other country, but it's not the United States, says, okay, Israel, you are an occupying power, and the occupation has gone on so long as to be unlawful, and the settlements on the West Bank, for example, are illegal. But everybody agrees with that, actually. So if you have a look at, for example, Resolution 799 of the Security Council of the United Nations on December 18, 1992, it reaffirmed the applicability of the Fourth Geneva Convention, 1949, to all the Palestinian territories occupied by Israel since 1967, including Jerusalem, and the resolution defines Israel as the occupying power. The United States voted in favor of that resolution, and to my knowledge, as a matter of law, hasn't changed its mind. Yeah. So what's it mean? If Israel is an occupying power, a number of things flow from that. That is that it is bound to the Fourth Geneva Convention, which doesn't allow serious violations, transfer of by the occupying power of its civilian population onto the territory it occupies, or anything like that. So this has been reaffirmed time and again. So, for example, the International Court of Justice was approached and rendered an advisory opinion, a unanimous advisory opinion on this point, in a case called The Legal Consequences of the Construction of a Wall in the Occupied Palestinian Territory, released in July 2004, where it says clearly that the territories are occupied territories, and Israel has the status of an occupying power, and subsequent events, nothing has happened in the territories to change that situation. Again, no serious international scholar disputes that, but the difficulty from the point of view of those people who claim that Israel simply acting in self-defense is the point that Michael makes. An aggressor can't rely upon self-defense to justify violence against resistance to its own aggression. And the maintenance of effective control over Gaza and the continued occupation of the West Bank and the continued existence of and indeed building of territories are all illegal and acts of aggression as a matter of international law, particularly since, again, everybody, and including under the Oslo Accords, it was agreed by then Prime Minister Rabin. Maybe I've got my timing wrong, but again, Michael does the history of it. But Palestinian people have a right to self-determination. Mm-hmm. So, again, Michael quotes from the judges at Nuremberg, and again, he's not making a sort of one-on-one comparison between the activities of the Germans in Europe or, frankly, South Africans in Namibia. But the general principles are the same. The Nuremberg judges said in one of the Nuremberg cases, an important case, the trial of Otto Ohlendorf, said that if it's assumed, he's talking about the actions of the Germans in Russia, the reprisals against a population that carried out acts of violence against the Germans. So Nuremberg said, if it's assumed that some of the resistance units in Russia or members of the population did commit acts which were in themselves unlawful under the rules of war, it would still have to be shown that these acts were not in legitimate defense against the wrongs perpetrated upon them by the invader. Mm-hmm. Under international law, as in domestic law, there can be no reprisal against reprisal. The assassin who's being repulsed by his intended victim may not slay him and then, in turn, plead self-defense.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, these are extremely important principles, yeah. and they need to be unpacked, frankly, the way Michael Mandel did, in order to figure out what's going on.
Yeah. By the way, let me just interrupt you there. This is, we're, of course, speaking to David Jacobs, who practices international law and has spoken on this issue many times and written about it. And the article by Michael Mandel, author of How America Gets Away with Murder, that article you said was in Counterpunch.
Yes.
Is that the one that you're citing? I mean, that was 2009?
February 5, 2009, there's an article called
You wouldn't happen to have
Peace.
Is there a title of that article? I'd be curious.
Sorry, Self-Defense Against Peace is the title of the article. And this is one of
By the way, people who are writing to their members of parliament ought to just, make that an appendix and send that along. Because we seem to be, you pointed out, that they use this expression self-defense, but it's not, they don't use it in a way that indicates how it conforms to international law. Instead, it's what we call in politics talking points, right? It's just a way to control the conversation.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think Michael agrees that. And Michael's not defending the use of force by anybody on all of this. He's just trying to unpack what's the actual situation as a matter of law. And in fact, what's profound, I think, about his appreciation is he's not saying, you don't need to sort of go into, well, who fired the first rocket or anything like that. What he's saying is the occupation is an act of aggression. And under international law, for example, the occupation, not even Israel, claimed that it originally occupied Gaza and the West Bank mainly in self-defense. And they're not saying that they're holding on to it in self-defense. In fact, Israel, again, really standing out there on its own, saying these territories are not occupied territory. I mean, famously, if you listen to Israeli spokespeople on the news, they just call them the territories. But they actually use internally the term disputed territories. Mm-hmm. And Michael, in his article in the Dartmouth Law Journal, which I really recommend reading because it's very comprehensive, it's a 50-page article, somewhat legally dense, but importantly so, he says that he quotes an Israeli spokesperson saying that Israel's claim to the West Bank is no less valid than that of the Palestinians. This territory held the cradle of Jewish civilization during biblical times, and Jewish communities existed there over thousands of years. Modern-day Israel has deep ties to many historical sites located in the West Bank. So, and that was a statement by the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs in November 2007.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't need to ask, well, who tossed the first rocket? It's the fact that Israel is claiming against all international law, it actually owns these places. And so if, in fact, international law is correct and these are occupied territories, not only does Israel not have a right of self-defense against them, but it has a right and an obligation to the people they occupy, firstly, to stop occupying them. Secondly, in the course of the occupation, to treat them according to the Geneva Conventions and take all necessary measures. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that police measures are not sometimes appropriate, but certainly not not what's going on at the moment.
Yeah.
But let me just make one more point, if you don't mind. That occupation, even let's assume then that everything that we said now is wrong, and Michael does this and says, okay, so Israel is occupying these territories in self-defense. Well, actually, under international law, which the UN Charter is the supreme international law, the constitution of the world, as Michael puts it, that's there to end the scourge of war, and it says that you can't go to war except in extraordinarily narrow circumstances. One would be, one circumstance would be, with the authority of the UN Security Council. That doesn't exist here. But the other would be in self-defense. But that self-defense is very limited, and it's limited until the United Nations Security Council steps in. Well, actually, the United Nations Security Council, at least according to Michael, and it makes a lot of sense, has stepped in for a long time and declared what the status of the occupied territories is. And the original president of the International Criminal Tribunal for former Yugoslavia, the late Professor Cassisi, says that occupation should discontinue as soon as the UN steps in. So it's long past the time when this occupation has to discontinue, according to international law.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, that ties in very nicely. We were talking things we had to say with David Heap, that, you know, now we have this extreme pain and a loss of life, and people say, well, we have to stop the shooting. But obviously, you also have to stop the occupation. That's what, then these things would not be on the agenda. They wouldn't be happening. There'd be no basis. We're speaking to David Jacobs, practices international law, has written and spoken on this issue many times. Of course, we've been citing also the words and memory of Michael Mandel, who everybody should have that book, How America Gets Away with Murder. And that's a question I have to ask you, David, too. And this is somewhat a political question, but it is also involves international law. Israel has a very interesting position in that they can say to their great good friend, and by the way, the two say they are great good friends. As a matter of fact, they say they're special friends, which is kind of curious in politics, that they're special friends. Their special friend, Washington, gets away with a lot of crime, as the title of Michael's book indicates. And all these things we're saying, when it goes to the brushes up against the shores of the United States, they say, oh, no, we're above international law. I mean, isn't that part of the big headache here? They're in a rather difficult position to tell Israel to toe the line when they themselves don't see a line at all.
That's a really important point. I mean, the U.S. is quite instrumental in the drafting of the Rome Statute, which set up the International Criminal Court. And you can hear from various sides and calls for, I guess, U.S. leaders or Israeli leaders or so on to be brought for the International Criminal Court. I think there were even calls by people supportive of Israel for Hamas to be brought for the International Criminal Court.
They sent commandos to catch Yugoslav leaders, didn't they?
Yes. No, exactly. But the irony is this. Two things happened which are very important about the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. One was that the U.S. was under tremendous pains to make sure that crimes against peace were not within the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. And that's actually true of all of the current international criminal courts, the Rwanda Court, Sierra Leone, etc., etc. So what does that mean? According to Nuremberg, there were three types of war crimes: crimes against the peace, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. But of the three, the supreme war crime was the crime against the peace, which is defined by Nuremberg and subsequently ratified by everyone in the world, as far as I understand it, is a war of aggression or a war contrary to international treaties. And the Nuremberg Tribunal, and the prosecutor at Nuremberg, I guess, Robert Jackson, a U.S. Supreme Court judge, said that the crime against the peace was a crime that, I'm not going to paraphrase as well, but contained within it the evil of the whole, so that war crimes and crimes against humanity were subordinate crimes to the overarching crime of starting a war of aggression. And that is, of course, what the Nazis were mainly charged with at Nuremberg. So the U.S. says, no, that crime, we'll just talk about people doing bad things in the midst of a war. We're not going to talk about who started the war. And so that means that the U.S. can't be prosecuted before the International Criminal Court, for example, for its commencement of the war against Iraq, which, as we know, led to untold deaths and destruction.
And counting,
or the war against Libya, or the war against Afghanistan. And again, particularly in terms of Iraq and so on, the majority of international law scholars will tell you that was a war of aggression, a crime against the peace. But even worse than that, the Americans, although they were instrumental in, and Michael says this in his book, How America Gets Away with Murder, they were instrumental in making sure that the Rome Statute couldn't prosecute, under the Rome Statute, no nation could be prosecuted of a crime against a, peace. The Americans are not a signatory to the Rome Statute. And not only that, but the Americans have deals with other nations to make sure that no American citizen, military, etc., can be or should be extradited for trial before the International Criminal Court. So,
you know, the idea that they could now be helping us out solve this is somewhat, well, ridiculous.
It is. The Supreme, as Michael put it, I think, I keep quoting Michael, but that's what we're here to do. I mean, he was so good on this stuff. The Supreme Crimes and the Supreme Criminals can't be brought to book.
Yeah. Very important point. Hey, David, last point. I understand you're from Wales. Please give us a Welsh insight. It's true that the Welsh and the Scots and others are holding big demonstrations against the Israeli aggression?
Yeah, that's what I understand. There have been demonstrations in Scotland and Wales and so on, and the Plaid Cymru, which is a party of Wales, and the Scottish Nationalist Party, and I believe also Sinn Féin, they've all called for serious action to be taken. That is, that that Britain should no longer be sending arms to the Middle East to keep the struggle alive, and that there should be an arms embargo on arms going to Israel, which is frankly a point that was made even in the Daily Show, I think, by John Stewart the other night.
So. Well, I like to take my leadership from Cardiff, and I saw that the Cardiff Peace Organization had a terrific demonstration and some very. If you go to their site, some very witty observations about all this. We take heart from it.
So I think at the end of the day, Michael, in trying to set out the international law and doing it well, was setting out a path to a peaceful resolution, which is what everybody wants. And the rhetoric aside, that's what...
That's what they say, and we're going to hold them to it.
There you go.
Yeah. David, thank you very, very much. David Jacobs.
Thank you. Yep. Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay, Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And you can check us out, taylor-report.com. And then Facebook, Facebook.com/TheTaylorReport. So, Andy and company and Phil Conner, thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week.